The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and we're coming to you live. We haven't done that for a few days, actually, but we're coming to you live here from our offices in Edstone, England. We've been having a bit of a hiatus celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles. I'll talk to you a little bit about why, where we've been for the last 8-9 days or so on this show a bit later. But we're back now into our schedule of live programming. Mr. Stephen Flurry is currently on the way to Jerusalem. He and his dad and a few others, they've been over here for the last few days. They're now flying over to Jerusalem, and I believe he hopes to come to you from Jerusalem tomorrow. That'll be an exciting program. Be sure to look out for that. I think that he may even be coming to you live from Jerusalem. I think it depends a little on exactly the schedule over there, but definitely a show not to miss. Well, even though we've been on break, the news hasn't. Lots and lots of things going on over the last week or so, and I'm sure we'll be bringing you more and more of some of those updates of those pieces of news as we go through the next week. And one thing that caught my eye really even just this morning is, well, we heard about it a little in the top of the hour on the headlines if you were listening to our live radio show. Germany looking at getting involved in Syria, with the German defense minister, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, telling Deutsche Welle that she has a proposal to see German troops being deployed in Syria, scaling up their operations there. So she talked about having an internationally controlled security zone in cooperation with other European countries and Turkey and Russia. So you would have German troops there, European troops there. Deutsche Welle wrote that the proposal has the potential to lead to Germany and European military deployment to the region, marking an escalation of involvement in the Syrian conflict as it enters its ninth year. She said that the security zone would seek to resume the fight against terror and against the Islamic State, which has currently come to a standstill. It would also ensure that we stabilize the region so that rebuilding civilian life is once again possible, and so that those who have fled can return again voluntarily. Now, it goes on to talk about how this proposal may well not get through this current coalition, that the coalition government is pretty shaky. It's very hard for them to take any kind of decisive action. And German troops deploying on the ground to Syria is pretty decisive for Germany. And so it talks about how, well, this may not happen. And they may be right about that. They're absolutely right that this is a shaky coalition, that it is very hard for it to get anything done. But I think what this news does show is that you've got a Germany that's increasingly keen to get involved, not just in the Middle East, but in Syria. And I just think this is fascinating, because this is what we've been saying all along, you know, right from the very start of the Syrian crisis. We've said it's going to lead to Germany getting involved in the region. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had an article, How the Syrian Crisis Will End. You know, note that very firm title. You know, this is what's going to happen. This is how it will end. It's from all the way back in 2012. So we're looking at several years ago. And he laid out just exactly what we're seeing, that we're seeing Europe wanting to get more involved. So, you know, that's what he forecast. That's what's starting to happen. We've got more on this story on our website. And Brent Nachtigall had an article just last week on October 16th, The Solution to the Syrian Crisis, where he pointed to some of the latest events with America pulling out of there. But Mr. Gerald Flurry's article, How the Syrian Crisis Will End, it goes through the Bible foundation for this forecast. I mean, back when he was saying that in 2012, you know, yeah, there were definitely some people within Germany saying we need to get involved here. It's going to have a big effect on us. But I don't think there was any major news organization looking at that and saying Syria is going to, you know, Germany's going to be the solution. Syria's going to end up with Germany. Germany was considered a minor player, and sure, some in Germany may have wanted to be involved, but there weren't many really looking to that and paying attention to that. But because of Bible prophecy, Mr. Flurry said, well, watch what Germany does in Syria. And now, several years on, I think we're seeing Germany making this big push, so much so that it even makes the top of the hour news to get involved in Syria. And you can read that article, How the Syrian Crisis Will End, and that's based on a prophecy found in Psalm chapter 83. It's a prophecy that describes Syria being part of a German-led alliance in the Middle East. And that article will explain much more about that. Well, one of the big things that I wanted to talk about, though, is Brexit. Like I said, we've been on a bit of a hiatus for the last few weeks, and we had our Feast of Tabernacles, and that was an opportunity for me to meet a lot of our church brethren from around the world who are also regular listeners to the show. And one of the big things, especially over the last day or two, that I've been asked is, well, what's going on with Brexit? We've seen all of these Brexit-related headlines, Brexit, 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 you know, all over the last few days. What is it all about? What's happening? In fact, it's so everywhere that just driving down the road, I think it was Saturday morning, just the short drive over to our meeting hall, there was a local shop. And just outside the local shop, there was a sign saying, get real, approve the deal. Talking about the Brexit deal. It's become so much, you know, everyone's become so invested in it. You've got shopkeepers putting out signs calling for a position. You really can't escape it over here. And there have been some very momentous events going on over the last few days. So we'll talk about some of those events, but first I want to reiterate some of the big picture. Because this does help us keep in mind and, you know, slot everything in, understand what is happening. So, of course, back in 2016, in the summer, we had that election, the Brexit vote, the referendum, will we leave the European Union or not? And Britain voted to leave. And what we've seen and what's become increasingly clear, especially over the summer, is after that, you've had a strategy to delay, confuse, and then block Brexit that's been brought forward by those that lost the referendum. When we had that vote, just about all of the elites everywhere, they all opposed Britain leaving the European Union. And after that vote, well, they've launched this strategy to delay, confuse, then block. I mean, the day after the referendum, we'll play our first soundbite in just a second. This is a clip. This is people both before and immediately after the referendum saying, this is it. This is the final choice. We get one choice. This is the only option for Brexit. You know, you can hear them again and again saying this. And you know, now these same people, then what they did is they tried to delay things for several years. And now these very same people are coming around saying we need a second referendum. But we'll hear this montage of all of these people saying we will not have a second referendum. This is it. This is clip one.
We won't be blocking our country, leaving the EU.
Well, I'm not actually trying to thwart Brexit.
But I'm certainly not going to take steps to obstruct Brexit.
There will be no second referendum.
The second referendum argument simply doesn't hold water.
No, I don't think we need a second referendum.
I'm sorry, I'm not one of those people who thinks we should be called in for a second referendum.
A second referendum would be very unhelpful.
There's no second vote.
We will not be taking a position like this again in our lifetime.
This is a once-in-a-generation vote.
A once-in-a-generation choice.
The once-in-a-lifetime decision.
The once-ever chance.
A once-and-for-all decision.
A one-off choice between staying in or leaving completely.
There won't be another referendum on Europe. This is it.
If we as a country decide to quit, then we're out for good. There's no going back.
You vote to leave, we're out.
That's it. We're going.
Whatever the British people decide, we work together constructively to make that happen.
I don't think it would be right for Parliament to try and unravel the decision that the public have made.
The British Parliament should deliver what is required of that decision of the British people.
We would have to accept the will of the public.
Whatever the result is, we have to respect it.
Labour accepts and respects the result of the referendum.
Have we got to accept the result?
Yes.
And Parliament should respect that referendum result. We've said that all the way through.
We respect the decision of the British people in that referendum.
We respect the votes of the referendum.
And we have to accept the decision of the referendum.
And genuinely accept the result.
The Labour Party accepts that we are leaving the European Union.
Britain is leaving the EU.
We're leaving the European Union.
We're leaving the European Union.
We're leaving the European Union.
Britain is leaving the European Union. Yes, we're leaving the European Union.
We are leaving the European Union, Boris.
We'll leave the EU in March 2019.
We will leave the European Union on March 2019.
Freedom of movement will have to end as we leave the EU.
Freedom of movement ends. There's no question that it ends when we come out of the EU.
We're leaving the single market.
Right.
We're leaving the customs union.
And by the way, we'll be leaving the customs union.
What will happen on leaving the European Union is that we cease to be members of the single market.
You have 2 years to negotiate.
So these are all people all in the run up to the referendum, and if you're on our YouTube channel, you would have seen that video where you can see who's talking. All these different politicians in the run up to the referendum, and then in the immediate aftermath of the referendum, saying, "This is it. This is a once in a lifetime choice." And so, what happened? You know, because everyone was saying in the run up to the referendum, "This is a once in a lifetime thing. This is a big decision. You need to take it seriously." And they were saying this to try and kind of scare people into voting to remain in the EU. You know, they said this once in a lifetime. Then you had the vote. They didn't like the answer on that vote. But it would have been pretty hard for them to turn around the very next day and say, "Oh, you got the answer wrong. We need a second referendum." Now, some did. There were some people even on day one saying, "We need a second referendum." But for the most part, it would have made those politicians look pretty ridiculous. And so this is why you had this strategy of delay and confuse. So instead of what they did is they just tried to delay it as long as possible, make it seem as big of an arduous a process as possible, try and make it as confusing as possible. And then several years later, now what we're seeing is they're coming out and saying more and more, "We need a second referendum." The British, they're coming up with all of these excuses as to why. Those excuses would have looked ridiculous if they'd have tried that back in the summer of 2016. But now they've delayed, now they've confused, now they're bringing forward these all of these other strategies and obstructions to try and have a second referendum. That was Steve Barker, by the way, an MP who put together that montage on Twitter. And as you saw at the end of that montage, they were also all of these same people, they also said, "Well, we're going to be leaving all these other parts of the European Union. There'll be no freedom of movement. We're going to leave the customs union. We're going to leave the single market." They all said that's what Brexit means in the run-up. "We're going to leave all of these things." And now, though, again, two years down the line, they're saying, "Well, nobody voted to leave the customs union. Nobody voted to leave the single market. Nobody voted to end freedom of movement. We've got to keep these going, or it's not clear what people voted for. We need a second referendum." I mean, it was crystal clear back then, but now that they've delayed, we're seeing this new tactic. Andrew Roberts had a good article in the Daily Mail just a few days ago focusing on this big picture. It was called "Britain Needs an Official Inquiry into How the Elite Turned Brexit into a National Humiliation." And his argument in that piece is basically that we need to put together an inquiry to call up people before judges to see what happened. How you have this situation where all of these different elites try to overthrow the will of the British people, because we need to make sure something like this never, ever happens again. So what can we do to make sure we don't have people trying to overthrow democracy like this? He says we've had inquiries over things like lighthouse administration, cross river traffic in London, Tyneside local government, university education in Dundee. So he says something as important as Brexit can certainly be investigated for the lessons that can be learned. and how so many members of the British elite came to the avowed conclusion that they had the moral right to subvert the decision of 17.4 million voters simply because they disagreed with it. And he writes in here, unlike so many earlier public inquiries, this one must not be commandeered by the establishment, as it will be very largely the establishment itself which will need to come under the microscope. He also talked about how it can't be dominated by lawyers because, you know, the lawyers have all been against Brexit. And then he talks about all of these people that that should be called before this inquiry. He said they should call members of the civil service before them to explain why there were so many damaging leaks against the Brexit process, which never led to any whistleblowers being prosecuted, but virtually none damaging to Remain. So again, just like you see in America, you've got all of these whistleblowers or all of these leaks coming forward, mostly, you know, leaks just about in the States, you know, coming, there's all of these leaks all the time against Mr. Trump, and they're all coming from one side, all of these different leaks. Why are they so one-sided? This article says they will be able to ask senior BBC figures this inquiry why the neutrality over Brexit during the referendum campaign so spectacularly collapsed across the corporation the moment Leave had won. He also writes that a committee would almost certainly call the by then ex-speaker John Bercow before it and ask him to justify his claim that he was neutral between Remainers and Brexiteers when every major decision helped those who sought to ignore the people's will and none helped those trying to implement it. This is something that's come up just in the last week, it was just yesterday. We'll talk more about that in a second, but you see his very one-sidedness. Andrew Roberts wrote that precedents from the 17th century recited one minute and ignored the next. The Benn Act was passed without due process. Everything right down to, and he talks about this obscene bumper sticker that he has on his car, would be investigated. He writes that the committee would examine whether the royal prerogative, which was thought over the past 300 years had legal force in this country, has instead been wholly passed over to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court taking power so they can stop Brexit. What about orders in council, he writes, made by the Queen on the advice of her privy councillors? The country fought its trade wars against the Napoleonic Empire based on the basis of orders in council. Do they still have legal validity now that they're all being overturned? Who now chooses when Parliament can and cannot be prorogued? He asks. He also talks about, well, maybe we need to report the Liberal Democrats to the Trade Descriptions Act or the Advertising Standard Agency. How can they call themselves Liberal Democrats when their whole platform now revolves around overriding and ignoring Democrats? Shouldn't they be called the authoritarian anti-democratic party? He says that might not have the same electoral appeal, but it is much closer to the truth. He also writes that the Committee of Inquiry could expand its horizons beyond politics and ask for an explanation from the Archbishop of Canterbury as to how his anti-leave pronouncements have not crossed the line by putting the prestige of his office in the Church of England on one side of the Brexit debate. Just about every institution in the UK has been against Brexit. So that's been the story of all of this all along. The latest saga kind of came late last week where Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the EU announced that they actually had a deal. They'd come to an agreement, and a whole load of people had said it was impossible for them to be any deal different from Theresa May's, that it couldn't happen. And some of those people came out later and said, well, actually, yeah, I guess we were wrong, that, you know, there is this deal, the EU did happen. I mean, this deal with the EU did happen, and it is different to Theresa May's. And the big question is this a good deal? That, I think, is hard to answer. I think it's definitely an improvement over Theresa May's deal. But the one that he announced late last week, there's a lot of Brexiteers split as to whether it is enough of an improvement over Theresa May's deal to be able to support it. And even the Brexit party is split. Nigel Farage doesn't like the deal. Some very senior members of the Brexit party do. And I think it goes for a whole load of other Brexiteers. There's just some very credible names on... you know, some supporting it, some against it. And just to go into some detail, because some people are asking me about this, on what this deal changes over Theresa May's. One of the big downsides of Miss May's deal was that it takes Northern Ireland hostage. It locks them in under European rule. Now, this Mr. Johnson's deal provides an avenue for Northern Ireland to escape that hostage taking. It gives them a vote on whether to stay in that arrangement or not. And they'll be able to vote on that periodically. I think it's every 4 years. So in some ways, that's much better. But then also, you know, will Europe find a way to make Northern Ireland's life very difficult if they do vote to leave that arrangement? Is Europe thereby going to continue to keep Northern Ireland hostage? I think that's a very real possibility. The deal also gets Britain out of the customs union, but it knocks a lot of the hard questions down the road. It, for example, one of these things called, it talks about regulatory alignment. So based on what this deal outlines, it looks like Britain is still on the path to quote-unquote regulatory alignment with the European Union. And what this means is Britain wouldn't automatically submit to EU law the way it is right now, but instead they promise the EU, we will meet the standards that you set or better. So Britain will be committed to having laws at least as strict as Europe's in a whole number of areas. So again, arguably an improvement over the status quo and over Miss May's deal, but one that still leaves us subject to Europe to a considerable extent. It also puts Northern Ireland in kind of this complicated arrangement with the UK. The UK is out of the customs union. It can go and sign its own trade deals. And Northern Ireland, under Mr. Johnson's deal, is allowed to benefit from those trade deals that Britain has. But then Northern Ireland also remains in the EU's customs area as well. It's kind of in this semi-detached status. And the idea is that if something comes from, say, England to Northern Ireland, and that it will stay in Northern Ireland, there are no tariffs or customs checks or anything like that. But if the EU thinks that those goods coming from England into Northern Ireland could travel beyond Northern Ireland and into EU territory, well, then there would be tariffs and what have you as it comes into Northern Ireland. So kind of a bit of a complicated arrangement. The DUP, this party in Northern Ireland, they are against the deal in large part because of this. They say it does erect a barrier between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. It's not as big of a barrier as it would have been under Miss May's deal, but it is still a barrier. And then also under this deal, while Britain controls its own borders, it does have to hand over, I think it works out to around $33 billion to the European Union. But then thereafter, it gets Britain out of paying all of the money that we have been paying. So again, it seems like it's a deal that's better than Miss May's. I think there's, and then the Brexiteers have kind of divided now into a couple of different camps over this. There's the one camp that says, well, let's not let great be the enemy of good. This deal moves us away from the EU. Let's take it. We've got all of the establishment against us. We've got so many people working to undermine Brexit. This is an improvement over the current situation. So it might be the best that we can get, given the opposition against us. Let's take it. And then maybe once we've taken that deal and we've started to move away from the European Union, we can move away in some of those other areas that we're still not so pleased with on the deal and use that to continue to move ourselves away from Europe. So that there's quite a lot of people on that side. Others are saying, well, no, this deal is a capitulation. Where we've been exhausted. The Remainers have dragged out this process for so long. They've kind of exhausted us, but we can't stop fighting. If we hold firm and if we refuse to compromise, we can get a proper Brexit, and we need to reject this deal and fight for something that's much more like what people voted for in the 2016 election, and we need to fight for a proper Brexit. So Those are the way that the pro-Brexiteers are dealing with the deal, and that's an overview of the deal that Boris Johnson got last week. But I think the biggest and most important part of the story is the way that the anti-Brexiteers, the way the Remainers have been behaving over this. Because for the last several months, those pro-EU, anti-Brexit politicians, they've been saying, we need a deal. We're desperate for a deal. Leaving without a deal is terrible. If Britain leaves the European Union without a deal, the sky will fall and glaciers will stalk the land and everybody's children are going to die and it will be the apocalypse. And so, well, now there's a deal. And if they reject this deal, it makes a no-deal Brexit a real possibility. So it's kind of hard for all of those pro-EU politicians, because of the way they've been talking, it's kind of hard for them to turn around and oppose this deal. I mean, this is the excuse they've been using for a long time. We need a deal. And they spend all that time talking about how critical it was to have one. So instead, they've gone back to their same strategy of delay and confuse. So rather than vote against the deal, because that would make them look kind of silly, they're putting forwards all of these complicated arrangements that would try and effectively kill it. So they can say, well, we didn't vote against the deal. We put forward such and such an amendment to it. When really the intention of that amendment is to kill the deal. But it because you make it a bit more complicated, it's harder for people to follow. And it kind of hides their attempts to just reach for anything that they can to keep Britain in the European Union. So this is what happened on Saturday. Saturday, in the run-up to that, journalists were calling this Super Saturday. This was the crunch time. This was when Parliament was going to vote on Boris Johnson's deal. And so the way that it was billed was, well, if Parliament would approve that deal on Saturday, then boom, we'd be out of the European Union October 31st, and then off, and then we'd be off, and we'd have this deal instead. What actually happened on Saturday is you had the so-called Letwin Amendment being approved, and this was basically designed to kill the deal. It was an amendment that said, well, even if we approve the deal, Britain will stay in the European Union for an extended period of time after October 31st. So after that amendment was approved, the government withdrew the bill. There was no point having this bill to get us out of the European Union that wouldn't actually get us out of the European Union because of this amendment. So they pulled it. They then worked with MPs, and then they wanted to put this bill again on Monday. And that was the idea, as they could negotiate with people. Things had changed over those few days, and they'd be able to put this bill forwards again. And then this time they hoped to be able to get it through without anybody amending this. That's when the Speaker of the House, John Bercow, stepped forward, and he said, no, the changes in circumstances haven't been big enough. You can't put this deal forwards. And this led yet again to a lot of accusations that he was being biased. Actually, we've got a montage of a few people talking about exactly what he said. We can play those for you now. This is clip two.
My ruling is therefore that the motion will not be debated today, as it would be repetitive and disorderly to do so.
I note the dilemmas you face mean that on occasion you will sometimes have to please some and not others, but it is becoming remarkable how often you please one lot and not the other lot. I would also remark, Mr. Speaker, that you have inveighed against most unusual things happening in this House, which you did not like.
Can you understand, sir, in the light of your comments, why some people perceive, perhaps incorrectly, that the only consistency one can find in your rulings is that they always seem to favour one side of the argument and never the government, who are trying their best to carry out the mandate given to them by the British people in 2016.
So a couple of politicians complained. There were quite a few that complained after that ruling, saying, well, this again shows the Speaker's bias, that he's in league with the Remainers, trying to frustrate Brexit. So that was what we saw yesterday. And that brings us to today, the so-called Titanic Tuesday, because, well, this is being billed as the day that Saturday was meant to be. So what happened on Saturday and what the government was trying to put forward was a so-called meaningful vote. And the idea behind the meaningful vote was it would say, okay, this is roughly what we intend to do. We want to bring about legislation that would implement the deal. If we do put forward all of this legislation, because that's going to be a little bit complicated and it will take a fair bit of time, if we put this forwards, will you support it or not? And to gauge whether the House would be in favour of this before they actually spent all that time getting all of the details passed into law. That was blocked. So now today they're moving straight into the actual vote, just getting down to putting all of those details into law. And if that gets approved, then Britain will have voted for the deal. And so that legislation will be set forward before Parliament over the next 3 days. But today, on again the so-called Titanic Tuesday, the focus is on a so-called programme motion. Lots of terms here, I guess. But what this programme motion is where the government lays out and says, okay, this is how we're going to get this legislation passed. This is the programme for the next 3 days. This is the schedule. We'll have a vote on this here, and then we'll have a vote on this bit here, and this is how we'll get it through the House of Commons. And this is seen as the key test, that if the government has enough votes to get the programme motion through, it will probably get everything else through. Whereas for the those that oppose this deal, this is kind of their best chance to stop it. And again, because the Remainers, their whole strategy is delay and confuse, and they can't kind of openly vote against a deal, the programme motion is the perfect time for them to oppose this. Because they can say, well, you know, we're not voting against the deal, but we're voting against the programme motion. We're concerned that there's not enough time to scrutinise it properly. We're concerned that we're pushing this through the House of Commons too quickly. So again, it provides them with a whole lot of excuses to delay and to confuse without them having to be straightforward in what they're trying to do, which is find any way possible to block Brexit. So that programme motion will be going through today. And like I said, that's the key test. So if approved, then it seems like we are on course for Mr. Johnson's deal being approved. If it's not approved, then it seems like that deal probably won't be approved. Now, if it is approved, then I think the European Parliament and some other European officials also need to give their approval to the bill. And there are some question marks as to whether that will still happen by October 31st. So we'll still have to wait and see in terms of the exact date for Britain leaving the European Union. There's also a push as this goes through to have an amendment calling for a second referendum. Remember, we saw all those people saying that, well, it would never happen. We will never have a second referendum. They're all supporting a second referendum. And the thing that's so insidious about the second referendum, I mean, I could see kind of a case for a second referendum that says, well, do you want a no-deal Brexit or do you want to accept this deal with the European Union that we've recommended? I could see a reasonable second referendum along those lines. That's not what they're asking for. They're saying, should we leave the European Union? Or should we have this deal with the European Union or not leave? So should we have half a Brexit or no Brexit? So it really is a naked attempt to override the will of the British people. So they're going to be trying to push that through in the next few days. But again, coming back to the big picture, what this is all about is you had a vote to leave the European Union and an elite that are doing everything possible to override that. And this whole delay and confused strategy is all about trying to stop Britain leaving the European Union. The Telegraph had an article this morning, the new liberal God complex. People are only allowed opinions if they are the right opinions. And this article wasn't about Brexit. It was talking about transgender issues and all of these things. And it's right about that, but that's exactly the way things go on Brexit as well. People are only allowed opinions if they're the right opinions. The liberal God complex, so much on the left here, or these elites, they're setting themselves up like God. They know what's right, and they know that Brexit is a terrible mistake. It doesn't matter what people voted; they know best. They're going to do anything to get their will, and it's exactly the same spirit you see in the U.S. We had a president that won an election, but the elites, we know better. We know better than the people that voted for him. We know that he needs to be stopped. And that's exactly the same kind of thinking behind this impeachment inquiry. Well, they'll search for anything, and they'll finally find this Ukrainian transcript. And then they'll lie about what the transcript actually says. And they'll put in all of these clever like ellipses, dot, 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 and then they'll cut out most of a page and rearrange it so it looks like it says something that it did different. And then launch this impeachment inquiry based on that. Because, well, they know best, and it doesn't matter if they lie or cheat, they need to get rid of Boris, they need to get rid of President Trump. And over here, all of these same people, they said, well, we promise we'll support the referendum. We had an election 9 months later, and they said, yes, we will uphold the election result. And then it turned out that was all lies. They delayed it. They tried to confuse matters. They tried to make it look like this big drawn-out process. And now they're saying, well, you know, we need a second referendum. Because they think they know better. It's exactly the same spirit in both countries. And it's crucial to understand this spirit. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote about this in his book, America Under Attack. And again, that book, as you can tell by the title, it's specifically about American politics. But you see exactly the same spirit over here. And it's that understanding that's crucial to really see what's going on with Brexit. What's going on behind all of this, the division in Britain. What's going on between these elites that are going to go for this and you know, do anything that they can to stop Britain leaving the European Union. In that book, he began, I'll just read a little bit from the intro. He said, we live in a time unlike any other in history. World events are moving rapidly towards the end of this age. There is an unseen reason why troubles are intensifying as never before. You cannot understand events without recognizing this truth. An event occurred in 1986 that marked a major turning point in history. It has radically altered everything that has happened since. Culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations, everything we do. Yet what is most remarkable is almost nobody, no one even knows it happened. It has affected the United States in a massive way. In fact, it marked a major escalation of a violent attack on America. It is an assault by an invisible force, a force that is very real and deadly dangerous. The Bible provides penetrating insight into this troubling trend. The trumpet has written for years that America is prophesied to fall hard before it rises again, but it also gives extraordinary insights into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of the current events in their true perspective. And then Mr. Flurry writes, this force is mysterious. It is a spirit that prevails in the United Kingdom. So the same spirit is here, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the Jewish state in the Middle East. But the main focus is America, because this evil force knows where the real power is. By bringing down the world's number one superpower, it can bring down the others as well. So the main focus is on the United States, but the same spirit is present in Britain as well. And so we see the British elites responding to the same way America's elites responded. Britain's deep state, you could call it, responding in the same way as America's deep state. Well, we know best. We need to overthrow the will of the British people. You see the same massive division in both countries. At one of his messages during the Feast of Tabernacles, Mr. MacDonald, a trumpet contributing editor, Brad MacDonald, he showed a video just showing how much anger there is in our politics. We've seen this with the Extinction Rebellion protests all around the world. You've seen this with just how rabid the left have become in their attacks, both on Boris Johnson and on Donald Trump. You know, on both sides, you can see people just standing up in legislatures and things like that and screaming, literally screaming with rage at the other side. You know, there's something not normal about this level of division and hatred in both our countries. And that's on display with Brexit. It's on display in the United States as well. It's all about this unseen spiritual dimension. And that unseen spiritual dimension is that there is a devil. The Bible talks so much about that. You can't say, well, I believe the Bible without believing in there being a devil. And that he has an interest in, that God has a plan for this world and that Satan hates that plan. Now, God's more powerful, and Satan, what he can do to stop that plan is restricted, and often even what Satan is allowed to do ends up supporting God's plan. But there's a devil, and he opposes nations that God is working for. Britain and America have a history with God, and so Satan hates that, and he attacks them. And that's what we're seeing in this division. And that attack is just getting worse and more ferocious. And Mr. Flurry explains that fully in his book, America Under Attack. If you haven't read that, I'd really urge you to read that. Again, even if you're not American and have no interest in American politics, yes, there's a fair bit of American politics in there. But the main focus of that book is on this spiritual attack. And that we see that same spirit in all of those other countries. I mean, Mr. MacDonald mentioned the United States, Canada, where we just had that election over there, Australia, New Zealand, Israel, the Jewish state in the Middle East, all of these countries. It's the same spirit. And that's really the heart and core of that book. So you can order that book for free on our website, thetrumpet.com, America Under Attack. That's the real, and it shows the real source of all of the division and problems that we're seeing. Well, we'll take a quick break. When we get back, we'll talk about why we took a longer break over the last few days. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on 101.3 on the FM dial at kpcg.fm.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Hello and welcome back to The Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Now, we've been talking about Brexit in the first three quarters of the show. But what I want to answer now is, well, why have we been on break? And I don't mean the last two-minute advert break, but we haven't really had any live shows, I don't think, over the last eight, nine days or so. We did have some new content. If you have been just coming back to this show as well, we did have some pre-recorded programs go up over the last week that you may not have heard. You can look those up at our website, thetrumpet.com, or at our SoundCloud page. I don't think those pre-recorded shows went up on YouTube, but we do have some new content that you can catch up on. But why did we take just over a week off? Well, we did that because we're keeping a festival commanded in the Bible, the Feast of Tabernacles. I just thought I'd review that with you for the last few minutes of the show, just in case, you know, if you were wondering where we've been, this explains why. And God outlines a whole festival calendar, a holy day calendar in the Bible. I was about to say in the Old Testament of the Bible, and it is in the Old Testament that God does list that outline, but just about all of these festivals are also mentioned in the New Testament too. And Jesus Christ kept these holy days. The disciples kept these holy days. Jesus and the disciples did not keep Easter. They did not keep Christmas. You can't find any mention anywhere in the Bible of God's people keeping those festivals. But you see all kinds of references to these ones that we're going to talk about today. Now, one of these is called the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Ingathering. It has several different names. You can see it referred to in Leviticus chapter 23, and Leviticus chapter 23 and verse 34, for example. 33 says, "And the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, The 15th day of the seventh month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days unto the Eternal. On the first day shall be an holy convocation, you shall do no servile work. 7 days shall you make an offering made by fire unto the Eternal. On the eighth day shall be an holy convocation unto you, and you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Eternal. It is a solemn assembly, and you shall do no servile work therein. So there's a Feast of Tabernacles that adds that lasts 7 days, and the first day is a Sabbath, a holy day, and then there's another Sabbath on that after the seventh day. So there's another day added on the end there at the end on that last day, the so-called, or what we would call the last great day. So you have this outlined in the Old Testament there in Leviticus, and you can see God's people keeping it when they're obeying God. For example, in Nehemiah chapter 8, you can see, there's a recording there of the children of Israel when they'd come back, or the Jews, one tribe of the children of Israel, the tribe of Judah, when they'd come back from their Babylonian captivity, keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. That's recorded in Nehemiah 8 and verse 16 and 17, and it describes them keeping this. It says, so the people went forth and brought them and made themselves booths, every one upon the roof of his house and in their courts and in the courts of the house of God and in the streets of the water gate and in the street of the gate of Ephraim. And all the congregations of them that were come out of captivity made booths and sat under booths. For since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, and to that day, the children of Israel had not done so. And there was very great gladness. And day by day, from the first day until the last day, he read in the book of the law of God. And they kept the feast seven days, and on the eighth day was a solemn assembly according to the manner. So they kept this feast, and they rejoiced, and they read God's law, and they kept this holy day. And then the Bible also records Jesus Christ himself keeping this feast day. We can see this in John chapter 7. John chapter 7, and I'll just read from the start of this chapter. It says, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he would not walk in Jewry because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. Now it says here, the Jews' feast, the Bible Correspondence Course says, we should not interpret this to mean that God intended only the Jews to keep the feast. John was writing primarily for Gentiles, and before conversion, the Jews saw the feasts only as part of the different religion of the Jews. By this time, the ancient nation of Israel had lost knowledge of God's holy days. Judah, on the other hand, had preserved the Old Testament scriptures, the festivals of God and God's calendars. So it would have been natural for John to distinguish the feast he was talking about by naming the people who were keeping it. You know, the Gentiles, they had lots of their own feasts. So what feast is he talking about? Well, the Jews' feast. It also notes the Correspondence Course beyond that. John was also drawing attention to the fact that it was the Jews' feast because God was not in their celebration of it. The Jews were at that very time plotting to kill the Son of God. But we can see in this chapter Jesus Christ keeping the feast. The Jews clearly expected him there. Well, we can see in verse 10 that when his brethren were gone up, then went he also unto the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. So the Jews were trying to kill Christ, but he still went secretly to the Feast of Tabernacles. And then verse 11, the Jews sought him at the feast and said, where is he? So this had been his custom. The Jews were used to Jesus Christ attending the feast. It is something he had always done. And so the feast is here, they want to catch and kill Christ. This is a time for them. This is an opportunity for them to do so. So they're looking for him, keeping an eye out for him. The Correspondence Course notes, Jesus' purpose in going to Jerusalem was not merely to preach and to instruct people. He had numerous opportunities to address the multitudes who followed him continually. You know, he was going there in secret, but he still made sure that he went there. The Bible also prophesies of people continuing to keep the Feast of Tabernacles on into the future as well. Now, it's not just something for ancient Israel that is now done away with. You can see prophecies in Hosea, for example. Hosea chapter 12 and verse 9 talks about, well, it says, I am the Eternal, your God from the land of Egypt, will yet make you to dwell in tabernacles, as in the days of solemn feast. So you're going to come back to keeping this feast, God is telling these nations of the world. You are going to keep it. And we can see that as well in Zechariah chapter 14, and we'll look at a few verses in that chapter later if we have time. But this is something God commanded in the Old Testament. It's something Jesus Christ kept, And you know, his whole life, he lived his life setting an example for us that we should follow in his footsteps. You know, he kept this feast. They're commanded to be kept forever throughout all your generations going back into the Old Testament. So this is something that is binding on us today, that you can go and see God's church in the New Testament kept. But why? What does God want us? Well, actually, I'll play just a quick clip about that. This is Mr. Armstrong, making this same point. I think it's always interesting to hear from some of those radio shows. So here's Mr. Armstrong, talking about the binding commands to keep this Feast of Tabernacles. This is clip 3.
Jesus attended the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, you know, most of you people today, you'd think anyone's crazy that would do that today, wouldn't you? If they would attend the Feast of Tabernacles. And yet, my friends, God Almighty instituted the Feast of Tabernacles to be observed forever for all of God's people, not just for Jews. It was for all people that are God's people. Now, Jesus did, and he set us an example. And he was the minister, the mediator of the new covenant. And he set us an example that we should follow his steps, and he did keep the Feast of Tabernacles, and God commanded it forever. And every nation is going to be forced to keep the Feast of Tabernacles very soon when we have world peace.
So Jesus Christ kept this Feast of Tabernacles. He set us an example in keeping this Feast of Tabernacles. And like I said, it's just great to hear that from Mr. Armstrong. That was what he was telling this world for years. And that was from his radio show. But God teaches us so many important lessons through this Feast of Tabernacles. Now, this is also called the Feast of Ingathering. It was a feast that came after the harvest season in Israel, in the Middle East. So God, to portray his plan, he took the yearly material harvest season in ancient Israel as a picture of his spiritual harvest of souls. In the Holy Land, there are two annual harvests. You have the spring grain harvest and then the main harvest in the autumn. And so the Feast of Tabernacles is to be held after this autumn harvest. Like I said, it's called the Feast of Ingathering. And God just has a magnificent picture through these harvests and through these festivals. You can look in the book of James, chapter 1. James chapter 1 and verse 18. God talking about the church, he said, "Of his own will begat he us in the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. So you have this smaller harvest of first fruits, the first harvest of the year. And that's, like I said, it's a much smaller harvest. And then you have the great autumn harvest, this much bigger harvest. And God uses that to really teach us a powerful picture. That there's a smaller harvest. And God says, well, the church, they're only first fruits. You're a first fruit. You're part of that small harvest if you're part of God's church today. But God has a plan for a much bigger harvest, to bring in vastly more people into his family. And that's coming in the future. In Isaiah 59 and verse 8, for example, you don't quite turn there, but God talks about a day of salvation. Today is a day of salvation. But then there's another day of salvation coming, where there'll be a great autumn harvest, and where dramatically more people will be invited into God's family. This is one of the things that God pictures with the Feast of Tabernacles. This is one of the lessons that we can learn from this feast. I'll just play one more clip from Mr. Armstrong as we conclude, where he just talks about the value in keeping this Feast of Tabernacles, as he, even as an old man in this clip, just kept learning about God's plan more and more deeply through keeping these holy days.
Have you gained knowledge of the things of God since last Feast of Tabernacles a year ago? I have you? I'm in my 90th year now. But I've learned a lot in this last year. And I try to pass on to you what I've learned, and I'm passing on some of that to you today that I did not know a year ago. Are you closer to God than you were a year ago? Just where do you stand? The church is going to be ready, but are you going to be ready? That doesn't mean everybody in the church, brethren. You need to realize that.
So God has a wonderful holy day plan that just keeps us learning. No matter how old you are, Mr. Armstrong, as he said, was in his 90th year, still, you know, and at that point, you know, how much did he know and understand of God's plan? And yet still he was saying, well, by keeping these holy days, I'm learning more and more every year. God has these wonderful holy days to keep us learning more and more about them. So that's where all of our staff have been over the last few days. If you want to learn more about that, please, the Feast of Tabernacles and all of God's holy days, please do write for our free book, Pagan Holidays or God's Holy Days Which. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can read that online. We'd be more than happy to send you your own print copy. And it really is priceless truth about these wonderful holy days of God, the one he commands in the Bible, the one that Jesus Christ kept, the one that God's church keeps, the ones that God's church keeps today. So like I said, you can learn more about that at thetrumpet.com. Mr. Stephen Flowey should be back tomorrow, coming to you from Jerusalem. So please do tune in to that and listen in here on 101.3 on the FM dial in the Edmond, Oklahoma region or at kpcg.fm.